It's 6:02, and you normally in this spot will hear It's the Economy. However, we are preempting this It's the Economy this evening to bring you special election 2015 coverage. We're going to have a debate on two very important issues in the city of Boulder, Proposition 300 and Proposition 301. They both deal with development, one about neighborhoods having the right to be involved directly in the decision that affect the decisions that affect them, and the other about development and development developers paying the costs of development. I'm not going to go further in describing those. I will leave that to our very knowledgeable guests. And our format is that the pro side will begin on issue 300, and Mike Marsh will get to speak for 7 minutes. Then we will go to a presentation by the con side. And that will be Will Tour.
Susie Adjutant.
I'm sorry, Susie Adjutant for 7 minutes. Then there will be rebuttal for 5 minutes on the pro side. And that will be Will Tour. I'm sorry, I'm not getting this right. Help me out, folks. The con side for rebuttal
will be for Susie Adjutant.
Will be Susie Adjutant. Thank you, for 5 minutes, and then the pro side rebuttal will be by Mike Marsh, and then we'll take your questions and comments for a very few minutes, and then we'll move on to number 301. So, it's time for the pro side to begin, and here's Mike Marsh.
Well, thank you for having me here. I'm a neighborhood resident and just a concerned citizen. So, Measure 300 is an extremely limited initiative that essentially provides neighborhoods the right to an appeal vote if they're going to be rezoned by the city. It pertains to widespread wholesale rezonings of neighborhoods, and if your neighborhood appeals, or I should say petitions, they could get a majority vote. It would go to a majority vote of all the registered voters in the neighborhood. That's what it's about, and it's a very simple, limited initiative. Some of the things it won't do, because there's been a lot of misinformation about this, it won't allow a neighborhood to decide for any other neighborhoods. Each neighborhood vote just applies to itself. It exempts projects such as additions and renovations to existing residential structures that don't add entirely new separate dwelling units. Most residential remodels don't do that. A dwelling unit is something that has an entirely separate kitchen and entrance and things like that. So it won't affect your ability to work on your house. It won't affect anyone's ability to request and receive all the variances that are currently allowed under our regulatory system. Again, it's a pretty limited thing. It also won't allow neighborhoods to vote on specific projects, either commercial or residential projects. And a lot of the community-wide benefiting projects that opponents have brought up never would have been subject to a neighborhood vote. The North Boulder Homeless Shelter never would have been subject to Measure 300. The Bridge House project in my neighborhood, transitional housing for formerly homeless individuals, never would have been subject to 300. It does not apply for projects in other zonings. It only applies to your own residential zoning that you happen to be in. So it's very limited, but opponents aren't painting it that way, and it makes me really wonder what they want to do to neighborhoods where they feel uncomfortable with it being subject to a majority vote of residents. Their uneasiness with that frankly makes me a little uneasy. To me, Measure 300 is democracy at its best. It's not divisive. If opponents believe that democracy or citizen referendum measures are divisive, I think we're in real trouble. To review some citizen referendum initiatives in Boulder's history, one established the Blue Line, preventing development above the 5,800-foot contour line, like on Flagstaff Mountain. They also established the 55-foot height limit, Citizens initiatives also established the women's right to vote on a national basis. And one of the things about 300 that you have to keep in mind is that opponents, the flavor I've gotten from them is that they assume the worst about neighborhoods. They assume the most selfish type of attributes of people, and I don't believe that. I value neighborhoods. I believe in myself and my neighbors. And I know from experience working on the Baseline Zero proposal in our neighborhood, we very much wanted that to be developed. And the developer's proposal, unfortunately, had lots of problems with it. Problems that the city had not caught, some problems that planning board hadn't caught. And it took our neighborhood group hiring a hydrologist and doing a lot of the footwork ourselves to actually ascertain and point out some of the flaws with the initial proposal. So I don't think that I don't shortchange neighborhoods, and I have a lot of faith in the way neighborhoods work. And another thing that I'd like to address is that Measure 300 doesn't carve up the city into 66 neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods exist with or without Measure 300. The initiative simply referred to a map on the city's comprehensive plan update site that lists 66 neighborhoods. It also, the initiative empowers city council to reasonably combine neighborhoods and add new ones. Defining an area is inherent with the notion of working within a specific area. There shouldn't be any problem with using definitions of what area you're talking about. And in terms of the timing of the of neighborhood voting, there's two ways it could go. The most likely, most probable by far, is that if the city rezoned a neighborhood, they would have 60 days to appeal, to petition for an appeal vote. And that appeal vote would most likely go to the next general citywide election. If that's the case, costs are minimal. It costs just mere pennies to add one more question onto a ballot that's being mailed to all the registered voters in a neighborhood anyway. That's the far more likely scenario. If the city was in such a hurry that they didn't want to wait that long to rezone a neighborhood, then they could call a special election. And we've been told that the costs there are between $1 and $3 per voter. That's what the election officials have told us. So for a neighborhood of 1,000 registered voters, it would cost between $1,000 and $3,000. For context in this, keep in mind the city just spent over $170,000 on right-sizing Folsom and to get us pretty much back to where we were before it. So it's important to keep in context the type of dollars that the city spends on a regular basis. Just looking down through my notes here. Now, some of the basis for neighborhoods' right to vote is that a couple years ago, the city planning department started developing some really aggressive neighborhood densification plans. They created a list of policies for radical density increases for neighborhoods, and then they convened a working group that sort of rubber-stamped those. And some of the proposals, for instance, were to quadruple, allow up to quadplexes or fourplexes on existing single lots in single-family neighborhoods. And recognize that that's a fourfold increase in density and a fourfold increase in parking issues, fourfold increase in traffic. And we don't so much as take a position on those issues per se, as we simply think that the people who live in the neighborhood, who best understand the on-the-ground conditions on a day-to-day basis, ought to simply have the right to an appeal vote in case the city were to really get it wrong with a rezoning. And you look at what happened on Folsom Street, I think there's ample evidence that it's possible that the city gets something wrong. And I see neighborhood right to vote as part of an important system of checks and balances, just to be able to you know, keep the city a little more honest, to keep it real, to allow people the right
and
to
And we've appeal. Got to call time.
Okay.
Mike Marsh speaking in favor of Measure 300. Thanks very much. And now speaking against Measure 300 is Susie Agerton. 7 minutes.
I'm a 40-year resident of the city of Boulder and a former member of the city council for 9 years. I also want to thank KGNU for giving us this opportunity for the debate. Will Tour and I are here representing a broad coalition of individuals, groups, and businesses that believe 300 and 301 are the wrong public policies for Boulder. It isn't that we think neighbors are selfish or are bad people in any way. We think this policy is bad. I do want to direct you to our website, oneboulder.org, for more information about our group and to see a list of our supporters, including many of your friends, neighbors, and workers. Why do we urge a no vote on these ballot items? Five words capture our opposition: divisive, unclear, costly, charter amendments. Let me talk first about 300. Divisive. 300 requires a division of Boulder's residential neighborhoods into a series of voting districts. The electors in these districts will have the potential to veto land use regulation changes affecting them. Thus, decades of Boulder's thoughtful, comprehensive planning can be undone with the votes of a small number of citizens. Remember, 10% of the electors in these voting districts will be able to call the election, with the majority being able to overturn what the council has done. We will be facing the potential of a patchwork of land use regulations, with adjacent voting districts having very different land use requirements. This new and untested process has the potential to pit neighbors against each other and will certainly make it more difficult to achieve the kind of regional cooperation and planning we have always sought. Finally, though not stated by the proponents, 300 seems designed to limit, if not preclude, shared housing, co-ops, and other smaller dwelling units from residential neighborhoods. If this is an outcome, it will further divide our community, and it will also make it that much harder to achieve our affordable housing goals. Now, why we think it's unclear. 300 has been sold as allowing your neighborhood the right to vote, to veto any land use regulation change you and your neighbors oppose. What the proponents do not say is that your neighborhood, as you know it, will not remain an independent voting entity, but will be combined with other nearby neighborhoods to create a new voting district. This voting district may or may not reflect your neighborhood's views and concerns. In fact, you may not even recognize it as your neighborhood, and it's unclear exactly how many voting districts there be across our entire community. There also is some ambiguity as to whether an individual project could trigger a potential vote. The city attorney has stated that this is possible if the project required a change in a land use regulation. The proponents disagree with this interpretation, so it will probably wind up in a court for a judge to settle. Costly. Let's talk about the cost to 300 to all of us. You can count on litigation, something both proponents and opponents of 300 agree will happen. How much legal wrangling and for how long, no one knows. But of this you can be sure, your taxpayer dollars will fund the litigation if 300 passes. Another cost will be the neighborhood elections, which 300 requires the city to pay for. This is an ongoing taxpayer obligation with an unknown cost. It really depends on how many elections there are. While some proponents suggest that 300 will rarely be used and it will really be a measure of last resort, I wouldn't count on that. And possibly the dearest price of all will be the effect that 300 will have within our community. For the first time, we will be divided into neighborhood-based voting districts, each with the potential to reject public policy decisions made by our elected council. Our model of representative government, as well as our comprehensive planning, will be eroded by this change. In addition, the risk of neighborhood opposition will have a chilling effect on projects of community-wide interest, such as homes for troubled youth, firehouses, and affordable housing. It is no surprise that the Human Services Alliance, a coalition of over 70 human service agencies in Boulder County, has stated its opposition to 300 and 301. The Alliance understands how 300 will hurt its clients and undercut the values we in Boulder have always placed on providing inclusive and integrated human services. Moreover, the city's housing authority and largest developer of affordable housing, Boulder Housing Partners, has also expressed its concern about the negative impact of 300 and 301 on its ability to build and preserve affordable housing in Boulder. The veto feature of 300 increases the risk of completing an affordable housing project and devalues neighborhood engagement in it. The position of these important organizations should encourage you to vote no on 300 and 301. If passed, 300 and 301 will become part of the city's charter. These undefined and untested measures do not belong in the city's founding document. Surely, as Colorado and Boulder voters, we have learned the lesson of unintended consequences when we place such measures in our Constitution or Charter. Let's not repeat that lesson here. So, in conclusion, 300 and 301 may sound appealing, but they are too divisive, too unclear, too costly, and they don't belong in our Charter. We can do better, and working together we will. Please vote no on 300 and 301.
Thank you, Susie Aitchison, for speaking against Measure 300. Now with a rebuttal for the pro 300 side is Mike Marsh.
I think if you look at the history of any type of community growth limits or community rights proposals, consistently the arguments that are used against them are many of the same that we've heard. Opponents tend to use a strategy of fear, doubt, and uncertainty. In all respect to Susie, what you just heard then was a list of things that would never be covered under the initiative, that would never be subject to the initiative. So we can list them all day long, but if they're not the subject of the initiative, it's a bit irrelevant. So some of the things that I'll talk about is, and by the way, opponents of community rights and things like this often say that, oh, it'll result in legal wrangling. That's one of the oldest. I just encourage people to actually look at some of the territory that we're talking about, and just time after time after time, you hear opponents saying things like endless litigation and cost, it'll cost jobs, things like this. And those are really facetious arguments, and I'd like to just talk about what the initiative actually pertains to. So we heard Susie say undoing decades of community planning. Let me be clear, Measure 300 doesn't undo anything. What it is it's a forward-thinking initiative that just gives the neighborhood the right to appeal if the city really gets it wrong in the future. There's already a patchwork of zoning regulations throughout Boulder. That's the nature of different neighborhoods being zoned in different ways that have different zoning regulations that govern them. In terms of pitting neighbor against neighbor, this is the one that I fail to see the most, because this is a vote. You all vote in national elections, in state elections. You may not vote the same way as your neighbor. So how does that pit neighbor against neighbor? No more so than it does in any national election. That's part of our democracy, is people's rights to vote differently. And, you know, it's tough to make opponents happy here. As soon as we listed the different neighborhoods that exist in Boulder, in terms of being flexible, we also included in there that the city council has the right to combine neighborhoods if it makes it a little bit more practical. And this was frankly a concession, trying to be reasonable and work with people, but you just heard our opponent using that against us, actually. So it's one of these things, I don't know how to make them happy, because if we had not included that, you can bet that they would have been critical of us for that. In terms of firehouses, that's silly. The neighborhood right to vote does not pertain to firehouses or any emergency response services. In terms of affordable housing, stay tuned for a discussion of Measure 301, which actually creates a 100% funding mechanism for affordable housing. So I don't see these arguments that are being leveled against 300. It's a very simple, limited initiative that just simply gives people the right to an appeal vote if the city really gets it wrong with a rezoning, something as close and personal and just near and dear to their daily lives as their own neighborhood existence.
Thank you, Mike Marsh, speaking in favor of Measure 300. We're about to hear a rebuttal against Proposition 300 by Susie Aitchison. I mentioned at the conclusion of the five-minute rebuttal, we will take questions for a very brief period of time from listeners who want to particularly questions, although we'll take very brief statements, but it will be really brief. The phone number to call is 303-442-4242.
Susie Edgerton.
Thank you.
First, I would take exception with the notion that this is an extremely limited measure. The blue line and the height limit were very limited. They were very precise. There were not debates about what the language meant. That is not the case here. There are at least two sections of 300 where the primary author and the city attorney disagree in what the section means. This is unusual in the sense that there is going to be a battle over what this means. Hopefully, as a community, we would want that to be resolved between the primary author and the city attorney. I think that's unlikely. That's where the litigation is going to come from, and it will be prolonged. The other thing that I wanted to mention was that there are a number of specific projects, and the comment from Mike was that this measure will not allow voting on specific projects. Again, I would note there was a memo from the city attorney that was sent to the city council describing how he anticipated implementing these provisions if they were to pass. He noted specifically that if a project needed a land use regulation change, it would be subject to a vote. So this is another place where we disagree and where apparently the city attorney also disagrees with the proponents of 300. I think the other things that I would say is that this is a proposal that does appear to really get at limiting opportunities for us to develop affordable housing within our residential neighborhoods. It makes me concerned because residential neighborhoods have some capacity there, and if this passes, it will be extremely limited. I will also turn this over to my colleague, Will, to comment on the siting of the homeless shelter, which was referenced by Mike.
Thank you, Susie. So, Will Tour, I've lived in Boulder for 35 years and spent 8 years on the city council, 7 years as mayor, and was mayor during the time period that we were trying to site a homeless shelter in Boulder. It was a really difficult process. Anybody who was around during that time period would remember the very vigorous neighborhood and community-wide discussions. It's the type of service that you have, if you're going to be a compassionate community, you have to have somewhere in your community. But it's very difficult to find a neighborhood that will accept. In order to move that forward, in fact, we did have to make a land use regulation change that would have been subject to this initiative. And I think it would have made it far more difficult to site that shelter. Going forward, there are multiple types of social services, daycare centers, all sorts of things that are very important to the community that we, as a community, may well decide we want to change the rules to, in some cases, make it easier, say, to site a daycare center. That would clearly be subject to this. I wouldn't describe it as a neighborhood appeal, but the neighborhood veto process. If you look historically at decisions, particularly around affordable housing, not just in Boulder, but across the United States, there certainly is a pattern that, in particular, wealthier neighborhoods tend to organize to oppose affordable housing. That's their right. They have a very strong voice in the process today, and I think that that's appropriate. The neighborhoods should have a voice in the process. But ultimately, it's important that many decisions be made based upon what is in the best interest of the community as a whole. And those individual neighborhoods should not have veto power over those decisions. One other point is that, you know, Mike described this as only applying to neighborhood-wide rezonings. It would quite clearly apply to certain regulation changes that are not rezonings. For instance, there's a conversation in the community right now about making it easier for people to have cooperative housing where folks can band together and share their home. There's a conversation about making it easier for folks to put in accessory dwelling units or granny flats that are typically done to allow an aging parent or perhaps a grown child to live in your home. Or there are often folks who are having a hard time paying their mortgage in Boulder and want a little bit of extra income by having a granny flat in their home. Those would clearly be subject to this.
And that concludes our time for the rebuttal on Measure 300. You just heard from Will Tour, preceding Will Susie Edgerton, and speaking on the pro side, Mike Marsh. We now don't have any listener calls, any questions that have come in, so we'll provide an opportunity for listeners at the conclusion of the debate on Measure 301. At that time, you can call 303-442-4242. Again, that's 303-442-4242. So let's turn to Measure 301, and we're going to begin with an exposition of the con side, the anti side, and that will be by Will Tour. Wait, we have a question from Steve Pomerantz.
Yeah, you suggested that you were going to read the League of Women Voters.
Right. I wasn't able to access that last minute. And so
just a thought.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
So we'll leave that to you if anybody wants to go into the specific wording or summary of these measures. So we're going to begin our debate on Measure 300, and Will Tour will lead off with the opposition to 301. Will Tour will lead off the opposition to 301. 7 minutes, Will.
Thank you, Joel. So 301 is titled, Shall Development Pay Its Own Way? One of the things that's striking, and one of the real advantages, actually, that the proponents have, is that as the petitioners, they got to name the ballot issues. If this was a ballot issue that had been referred by the city to the voters, it would have had a former neutral name that actually did more to describe something along the lines of, shall development fees and taxes be raised for certain purposes? And it would go through those purposes. It's hard to argue with the notion that development should pay its own way. In fact, that's been policy in Boulder for the last 45 years. And to hear the proponents talk, you would think that there had been no implementation of that, that the city had made no attempts during those years to increase development fees or taxes. In fact, development fees in Boulder are already the highest in Colorado, some of the highest in the nation outside of California. There's a 30-page long schedule of development fees, which includes over 200 separate fees in addition to a variety of taxes. If you look at the actual fees paid on some recent projects, the Solana Apartments, $11.7 million, the 29 Norsa Apartments, $7.8 million, Pearl West, $2.9 million. Fees and taxes on development accounted for $52 million of the city's $270 million budget last year. On average, the city charges about $40,000 in fees for a new apartment, and it would be about $50,000 in fees for a small retail site of 2,000 square feet. Though, despite an argument that I think Steve and I will have later on, many of those costs are clearly passed on to the people who live in those and to the small businesses that may rent them. One of the big problems with this initiative is how vague it is. How much would fees increase? The ballot language is so vague that no one can really answer that question. In discussions around housing fees, Steve argues that they should increase by a factor of 7 or 8. We don't know. May take years of litigation to figure it out. But if you look at the fact that already fees account for about 15% of the cost of a project in Boulder, if you were to increase that by a factor of 7 or 8, you'd basically be doubling the cost. I think it's pretty hard to imagine that you could double the cost and not have a major effect on the price of the housing and of the business space that would be produced. You know, I don't think anybody out there has a whole lot of sympathy for developers. You know, not many people in Boulder who would care whether developers need to shell out more money for a project. But I think we all care very much about how much is housing going to cost our fellow citizens. Will small businesses be able to afford this space? You know, that's why you see organizations like Boulder Housing Partners opposing this. It's why you see organizations representing small businesses like Downtown Boulder and the Boulder Restaurant Association opposing it. It's vague enough that the city attorney's office says that the city will stop issuing building permits if this passes for a period, an un, determined indefinite period of time to try to figure it out. And we don't know whether that will be all building permits. There's an argument between the proponent, who has essentially argued that it should apply to anything that doesn't have a building permit yet, or whether projects that are already in the pipeline will be exempted due to other state and federal laws. We don't know the answer. It may require litigation to figure it out. One of the key things is that the city attorney's office today is quoted in the paper releasing an analysis that this may well apply to individual home remodels. Throughout the last couple of months, as we've been debating this issue, the proponents have stated that this does not apply to remodels of existing homes. That's not what it says in the ballot issue. It could have been written so it would completely exempt them. What the city attorney was asked was if a residential project adding square footage for it would be put on hold. And the answer was, a short answer is yes. Many such projects will be put on hold, not indefinitely. You may have a permit that might add a bedroom, or you could, and if so, you could argue that it would add impacts because it fosters the ability for more people to live in the house. On the other hand, you might argue that it's much the same before and after the addition. It's an area where reasonable people could differ in how they would interpret it. So we don't know what the impact will be on remodels of existing homes. It will clearly stop them for a while, and it may add substantial costs. In addition, that Steve Pomerantz, who I believe did at least much of the writing of the proposed ballot issue, was quoted in today's paper saying that the reason that he did not exempt single-family homes was precisely because he thought that we should consider charging fees to people doing things like granny flats and shared cooperative housing. Think about that for a moment. This does not try to add fees, so the argument goes, for a wealthy person who scrapes an existing home and replaces it with a much larger home. But for people of modest means who are trying to make it in Boulder through sharing their home or adding a granny flat, it seeks to add fees and make it more difficult for them. You know, when you look at the impact on affordable housing, you don't need to take my word for it. If you look at the folks who actually do affordable housing, Boulder Housing Partners, the city's largest developer of affordable housing, they released an analysis of 300 and 301, that, you know, a summary is, at a time when our community needs to be doing everything possible to aggressively encourage and preserve affordable housing, we are very concerned that 300 and 301 will do just the opposite. It does not exempt affordable housing. An affordable housing project can seek an exemption from city council requiring a two-thirds majority. There, if you look at what it costs to do something like a concept review, they believe that preparing for that could easily exceed $100,000 and add a significant amount of risk to a project, and that the hurdle may prove to be much too risky for a public sector affordable housing developer. They're concerned about ambiguity, increased cost of housing, increased risk, decreased opportunity, eroded neighborhood engagement, and the impact on regional planning. That we need more affordable housing. We don't need to be making it more difficult. For all of these reasons, I would encourage folks to vote against 301 in addition to voting against Proposition 300.
And that's Will Tour speaking in opposition to Measure 301. Now we'll go for the statement in favor of 301 to Steve Pomerantz.
excuse me, I'm Steve Pomerantz. I've lived in Boulder for almost 50 years, over 30 years involved in Boulder politics, 10 years on the city council. Requiring growth to pay its own way has been one of the issues that I have worked on the longest, and I have become, I guess in relative terms, an expert on the case law and statutory law on the issue. So what does 301 actually do? It requires new development to pay the cost of facilities, infrastructure, and services needed to support that new development. That includes transportation, affordable housing, libraries, parks, rec centers, etc. If 301 passes, our roads will not become more congested because travel times must be maintained. We'll have less CO2 emissions per person because 301 limits growth in vehicle miles traveled. We'll have more money for affordable housing relative to the need because 301 ensures that all new commercial development pays its way, which is certainly not happening now. and our tax dollars will serve us, not subsidize new development. There are only two options to pay for the cost of growth. Either developers pay or the citizens pay through increased taxes or lower levels of service. There is no free lunch. Our current system is one where developers privatize the profits and socialize the costs. As Will said, growth pays its own way has been a policy of the Boulder Valley Comprehensive Plan. Yes, it's been in there for 45 years, and there have been 22 council elections since then, and it still doesn't pay its own way. You want evidence? Here's the evidence. The transportation plan, the only plan the city has that would actually prevent traffic from getting worse and actually improve it slightly, costs over the next 20 years $459 million above current taxes and fees. $459 million above current taxes and fees. Now, maybe they can get that plan to be more efficient and reduce that cost, but it's a big chunk of change. If you actually divide that by the number of new people and the number of new in-commuters, comes out around $20,000 a person. Well, maybe it's not going to be $20,000 a person. Maybe it's going to be 10, maybe 15, but it's not zero. Affordable housing. Our current linkage fees, which the city council just raised from what was effectively zero to $9.53 a square foot, requires 20,000 square feet of new office space to subsidize, to pay the full subsidy for one 1,200 square foot attached new rental unit. 20,000 square feet at Google's rates, 200 square feet per employee. That's 100 employees, one affordable unit of that size, the subsidy for it for 100 employees, and most offices are denser than that. Why should it be in the charter? There's a very good reason, because then the city council can't undercut it like they did with growth management. If you don't put it there, it's pretty much guaranteed that even if this next council did something, it wouldn't last. The people refer to the charter like it's the Constitution. It's not. In the last 5 years, there have been four amendments put, including this year, four out of the last 5 years, including this year, there have been charter amendments on the ballot. The only reason that isn't easy to change is because the council actually has to go ask the citizens to change it. What a notion. Now, as to the market effects, the recent study done by the Aspen Institute looking at affordable housing said the local real estate market sets the prices of market rate units, and developers of one project can't change the overall market price or rent. Therefore, the costs associated with construction of inclusionary housing, and in fact, all other fees are either absorbed by modest declines in land prices or reductions in developer profits or some combination of the two. No, fees don't raise prices. They reduce profits or reduce the cost of the land that people buy the land for. A city council can always subsidize a development that they want, even with 301, but they'll have to face up to the real costs. Now, with regard to what the fees should be and whether Colorado's too high, Will said something to the effect of, and I'm not sure I got this right, Will, so you can say if I didn't. You said an increase, the fees are currently 15% increased by 7 or 8 times, that I had said that. No, what I'm talking about is potentially the charge for affordable housing fees, not all of the fees. No, the city's fees now for libraries, parks, and that kind of stuff are somewhere in the neighborhood of what the real costs are. They're low, they're below, but they're not zero. The transportation ones are really abysmally low, and the ones on commercial properties for affordable housing are really low. Our inclusionary zoning program is actually not too bad, in fact. Although when people say it's 20%, in fact it isn't, because the charge is only 75%. So it's actually 15% if you read the city's code. So, you know, it isn't impossibly bad and it isn't impossibly good. But the thing is that right now, the big issues are affordable housing. The other big one is transportation. And transportation, we are simply not even in the ballpark of collecting the right amount of money. And affordable housing, the impacts of job growth on it are not being collected or even close.
That's Steve Pomerantz.
I'll save my minute for
Okay, very good. Steve Pomerantz, speaking in favor of Measure 301. Now speaking in opposition, in rebuttal, is Will Tour.
Thanks, Joel. So a number of points. You know, Steve stated that this would decrease carbon dioxide emissions. I would strongly disagree with that. I think the effect of 300 and 301 will be to drive much development out of the city of Boulder into sprawling development in places like Weld County, which clearly will increase carbon dioxide emissions. You know, the work is very clear from every academic study that the way that you reduce carbon dioxide emissions in cities is by transit-oriented development, walkable, bikeable communities with people living in smaller units. That's what reduces urban CO2 emissions, in addition to movement towards renewable energy. And Steve talks about the transportation costs. There's a lot of what I would describe as voodoo arithmetic in there. You know, I was on the council the last time we took a look at transportation excise taxes and fees. We hired the standard consultant, Tischler Buys, to take a look at this. They made no attempt in that process to actually calculate the net costs and benefits of development, or to look at what the actual costs associated, the actual transportation costs associated with new development were. They simply took our transportation master plan, took everything that was building or doing something new as opposed to maintaining what we had got, arbitrarily assigned that to new development, and divided it by how many square feet of new development we anticipated. Under that logic, if you cut the development in half, the price would double. The truth is that most of the things that we want in our transportation master plan have very little to do with development. We're not out there trying to widen our roads. We're doing things like adding better bicycle infrastructure, trying to get better transit service, trying to get more eco-passes into people's hands. We want those things because as a community, we want to be a community where people have multiple choices in how they get around. Very little of that is actually driven by new development. In fact, much of it, new development helps to pay for it. When it comes to affordable housing, you know, Steve's points would make a lot more sense if they had limited this ballot issue to affordable housing fees on new commercial development. They didn't. It also includes residential development. And residential development is so broadly defined that it potentially includes things that no normal person would think of as development. Taking an existing home, turning it into a housing co-op with more people sharing that home, that could be considered new development. Adding a granny flat would be considered new development. Permanently affordable housing is not exempted. There's a process by which it may be exempted. In addition, the way that actual affordable housing gets built in Boulder is typically as part of a larger mixed development. So you think of the Holiday neighborhood, which many people love. When I was on council, we approved that development with a double the underlying density in return for 45% permanently affordable, and the market rate development helped pay for the affordable. If you make fees so high on market rate that you can't do the market rate, you also kill the affordable piece. In addition, much of the actual affordable housing that's important to people who work in Boulder is not necessarily permanently affordable. It's often smaller units that are relatively affordable. And in fact, when you look at much of the condos, townhomes, and apartments that have been built in Boulder over the last several years, most of them are actually affordable to people who make between 80 and 100%, 120% of area median income. Precisely that middle class that isn't eligible for permanently affordable housing, but who are being driven out of the city by high costs. Another couple of points. You know, Steve's point, you know, arguing based on some analysis of inclusionary housing that increasing costs doesn't actually increase the costs that are paid by the people who buy or rent those units. I would take that with a big grain of salt. When we adopted the inclusionary housing ordinance, we took a close look at the sort of academic literature on this topic. What it concluded was that it is true that for very small levels of inclusionary housing that only add a few percent to the cost of the project, so 10 or 15% of units, but since you actually recover most of the cost of those units, your actual effective fee is only a few percent of the total project cost, that those really don't have much impact on the associated market rate housing, but that when you add fees that are much larger than that, in fact, they do have an impact. And we're not talking about a single project. And we're talking about multiple projects across the city.
And that's Will Tour speaking in opposition to Measure 301. Now a rebuttal in favor from Steve Pomerantz.
The first thing to look at, I've just hit a few points here that Will made. Whether the most recent market units that are being built in Boulder are affordable, they may be to somebody, but at $2,000 a month, which Boulder is now the highest in the whole state, or certainly in the metro area, sorry, I don't think they're affordable. With regard to carbon dioxide emissions, it is true that if you jam as many people as you can into as small a space as you can, eventually their carbon dioxide emissions will go down because they can't move anymore. That's not the kind of community I want to live in. My view is that Boulder should do everything it can to reduce its emissions on a per capita basis, but not turn the city into an intolerable place to live. I'm not particularly interested in having 200 or 300,000 people live here. It's that simple. Now, in terms of accomplishing something without trying to multiply your population, the city could start charging for parking for commuters. Just for example, Stanford University did that. Just by doing that and then you taking the money and paying people not to drive, they cut their overall VMT, vehicle miles traveled, by 39% and reduced their peak load and expanded the campus by something like 20%. So it's quite, all these things are quite doable without having turn the place into a bunch of high-rises. With regard to collecting all of the costs in the last study, not so. Tischler Buys, which was the firm that did the work, I discussed that matter with them. The way they do the work is they looked at the capital cost. The operating costs weren't collected. And the operating costs are the big money. If you're doing buses and all the things I think all of us want to do to reduce single occupant vehicle travel. With regard to impact fees on things like co-ops, well, question is, if you take a small single family house and you convert it into a co-op with a dozen or 15 people, there are impacts. Somebody has to pay for them. My view is if we're going to subsidize housing, we should subsidize through the development fees process, not by forcing people to accept the impacts. A couple other points here. The study, one other thing I wanted to say about this. It's going to come up at some point, so I'll bring it up now. The city could have, when it's started the current process, could have focused this study and done all of the work required for this initiative up front, so that by the time it got to the ballot, we would have known the numbers and there wouldn't have been any issues about delaying things. That was a failure on the part of the city council. In fact, it took the city 6 months just to write a request for a proposal to get consultants hired. It took them 3 more months to hire the consultants. They have dragged their feet on this whole process in terms of how any of this should be interpreted. And by the way, the city attorney who actually understands this stuff doesn't see any particular legal issues. They have dragged their feet on this process. The only explanation I can come up with is they don't want it to pass, and so they're creating problems where there don't need to be any. So if you're concerned about that stuff, and I think it'd be fine from my perspective if they did the studies and got them complete, and they were complete right now, then they could say, here's the numbers. But they sat on their hands. And so we're sitting there in a situation where we have to go with an initiative that sets the rules of the game rather than the numbers. And in fact, the numbers would be out of date in 5 years anyway, so then we'd have to have another one. That doesn't work very well.
Just one that Steve's thinking, one that I'll throw in. To dispense with this litigation argument, just as an example, this firm, Tischler Buys, has calculated over 900 impact fees for U.S. cities and Canadian cities. You look at their client list, all kinds of American cities are using impact fees. Boulder, truthfully, is behind the times on this. And it's interesting to note that none of Tischler Wise's 900 impact fees have been successfully challenged. So much for the legal argument. And just to put this in context, the city of San Diego did an affordable housing impact fee study, and they found that they would have to charge developers of new office buildings $72 a square foot to not go into the red as a city to provide those workers with affordable housing. In Boulder, we're at $9.53 a square foot, less than a seventh of the cost of providing affordable housing.
And Mike, we're going to have to stop right there. Mike Marsh speaking in favor of Measure 301, preceded by Steve Pomerantz on Pro 301. We've got about 7 minutes left, and we definitely want to hear from you. The number to call is 303-442-4242. Please keep your comment or question brief. And let's begin with Steve calling in from Boulder.
Hello?
Yes, you're on, Steve.
Okay. The negative or anti-debaters did a really good job. They talked about all the uncertainties and we have to be afraid of litigation and on, fear-mongering. In fact, these proposals are very reasonable and simple. Democracy should allow someone to have a vote about what goes on in their neighborhood. That's their private property right, and they ought to be able to vote on that. That's simple. It has nothing to do with affordable housing or anything else. It's a simple property right. You ought to be able to vote on it.
And Steve, do you have a Steve, do you have a question? Hello, Steve, do you have a question?
I don't have a question. I want to make a simple statement about the growth paying its own way. And it's a very simple thing, is we ought to have that so that we don't end up with the traffic congestion and the problems we have. We simply ought to have the developers that are causing the trouble, they should pay for what they're doing.
Steve, thanks very much for your call. We are at 303-442-4242, and now let's get a response from our panel.
So,
Will Tour.
So, you know, on 300, I very much disagree with the notion that this is just a simple exercise of democracy. I don't know of anywhere else in the United States that has tried to take land use decision-making down to a level where individual neighborhoods have not only input in planning development, which Boulder does, as do many other communities, but actually have veto power over those decisions. And it's hard for me to imagine what our community would be like today if this had been in place over the last 50 years. So I certainly don't see it as simply a simple exercise in democracy. When it comes to 301, again, you know, I think we ran through many of the problems with 301. You know, there would have been a right way to put this issue on the ballot. It would have been to have a specific proposal for this is how high the proponents believe transportation fees should be, this is how high affordable housing fees should be, and we could have had a reasonable community debate on it. But 301 as defined is so vague that nobody, either proponent or opponent, can actually say what the impacts would be.
Okay, could I get a brief rebuttal from the pro side, and then we'll move on to another caller?
Sure. So something that I encourage the listeners to keep in mind is that Boulderites are essentially compassionate citizens. We all have a high social conscience here in this town. I don't park that at the door upon entering my neighborhood. That's something I carry with me all the time. And I think that if there are community-wide needs, again, for all the listeners, I trust you and your neighbors to be able to figure that out. I really think that, you know, just that people having a voice in what goes on in their neighborhood is democratic. And I ask the listener also, think about right-sizing of Folsom Street. Would you rather trust yourself and your neighbors to have some input, or would you rather some city planner who has never set foot in your neighborhood ever to come in and right-size your neighborhood and create a disaster? I'm not saying they're going to, But I think Boulder would all sleep better at night knowing that you've got the right to an appeal vote.
Susie Edgerton, 30 seconds, and then we're going to move to another.
City planners are not going to be making those decisions. The city council is. And the city council is elected by the entire community. This is really a proposal 300 that basically changes our governance around land use regulations. It takes the authority away from the citywide elected officials and gives it to individual voting districts. To me, that is a fundamental problem and flaw.
Steve Pomerantz, I think we're not going to get time. Unfortunately, Melanie, I'm sorry we won't get to your call this evening, but we've got 2 minutes left. Let's go with more interchange from our panelists.
This is Steve Pomerantz. There are two types of democracy that happen in the United States. One is representative democracy. The other is called direct democracy. It isn't one or wrong and the other's right. They both work in the right situations. Sometimes direct democracy is necessary. And with regard to the implementation of 300, here's what the language actually says. The City Council shall adopt and apply standards and practices that are reasonably designed to achieve the requirements of this section and that are consistent with generally accepted professional standards and practices where such exist. These standards and practices shall include, without limitation, consideration of indirect revenues and contributions from new development, such as sales tax and use tax paid by occupancy, in consideration of multiple developments evaluated in aggregate. This is how consultants do the work. That's why it's written that way. And if we were to put numbers in, which would take the city having to spend all the money to do the work, and then you put the numbers in 5 years or 3 years, they'd be new numbers, and we'd have to vote on those again. That's why it's written this way, to get the job done once, rather than having the same fight every time.
Will Tour, you get the last word, 30 seconds.
So I agree with Steve that direct democracy is just as valid as representative democracy. We already have the opportunity for direct democracy on land use decisions. Decisions that are made by the city can be appealed by a petition carried by 10% citywide. That's the right way to do it, not to carve us up into 66 different voting districts. I encourage folks to vote no against ballot issues 300 and 301.
I encourage them to vote yes on 300 and 301.
Visit our website, livableboulder.org.
I wish that I could give everybody the last word, but it doesn't work that way. Thanks very much to Mike Marsh and Steve Pomerantz and Susie Edgerton and Will Tour for a very intelligent and civil debate. If you didn't hear the whole debate, you can go to KGNU's archive at kgnu.org. On the left-hand side, you'll see where the archive is. And go to It's the Economy, and you will find this debate in its entirety. Tune in next week at 6 o'clock, and you will hear It's the Economy here on KGNU, Boulder, and Denver. I'm Joel Edelstein. Thanks for listening.